Welcome back to the Higher Gear CIO podcast. I'm Kelly Kierens, president of Celtic QA Solutions. In this part of our series, we will jump back into the conversation on the future of work with Walt Carter, chief digital officer and CIO for Homestar Financial, and Dr. Ben Kaczynski, professor at the Goizueta Business School at Emory University.
It's interesting. I'm kind of with you in one regard. I keep wanting to tell everybody, look, skate to where the puck is going to be. Forget about where it originated. Where's it going to be? And in the future, it's got so many great possibilities with, you know, all of the way I explain it to people on my team is, look, you've got more people right now on the planet engaged in innovation work than at any previous time that we know of in the past. There are more innovators and engineers and discoverers and inventors, you know, that have been empowered and enabled and funded, and they are working on stuff that is coming to the shelf soon, right? It may not be on the shelf today, but there's some super exciting technologies and just simple things that, you know, people have thought of that could make life better. How do you curate all of that? And how do you think about the future, you know, with that kind of, I coined a phrase not too long ago called optopia, right? It's not about utopia. It's about how do I just get to where it's better? And how do we get a large mass of people thinking about and engaging in making it better, right? And making it better for tomorrow, not making, or as you said, not fixing the 20th century. How can I make it better for tomorrow and for the weeks to come after that? I just think there's so much more opportunity out there. And like I said, the masses of numbers, just the law of large numbers, you know, 7.9 billion people on the planet. And you know, we've lifted many, many of those folks out of, you know, the third world and up into the second or the first world. Many of them now are engaged in, you know, imagination and creativity, you know, and not all of it's going to pay off, but man, it could be a really great future if we will let it.
And we have 4.5 billion of those people that are connected now in internetworking environments. And even at that, we're outstripping by 20, 25, 30 billion things that are now connected. As those things get smarter, as those things get more engaged in decisions and creativity, we're accelerating the participation of creative innovation, novel decisions.
So one other thing that you brought up a few minutes ago, I've experienced very personally lately. I have four kids, almost all of them are full-fledged adults now. And my oldest son, not too long ago, you know, had an interesting conversation with my wife, his mother, and said, you know, I just don't want to work as hard as dad did. I don't mind working and I like having, you know, my job and the income, but I don't want to be on the clock all the time like dad's been for most of his career, you know, and I want to have those experiences. I want to be able to do things with my friends. I want to be able to go hang out and, you know, have these, you know, kind of game-changing experiences. Interesting, it's not about acquisition. It's not about possessions. It really is about experiences. And he's 30 years old, Ben. He's about 30 years old. You know, and I thought, that's an interesting thing, you know. And you know, he's a really talented DevOps engineer for a big company out on the West Coast and, you know, doing some really, really cool work down in the Kubernetes stack. That he's excited about and talks to me about all the time and tells me, you're one of the few guys that can actually understand this, Dad, right? Which is, you know, I don't really understand it. I'll be honest with you guys, I don't. But, you know, he thinks I do, and I just nod proudly, right? But I think that difference in what he values in terms of his work-life balance was kind of a big aha moment for me when my wife told me that story. I was like, really? And then I checked with, you know, my other three adult children, and largely they share that same mentality, right? I just don't want to be at work all the time. May want to take a year off every once in a while and just go do some fun stuff, kind of like your Nomad X team, right? But it's all about building experiences and living a full and complete life, not centered around work. I want to go one other direction with you on that, because you brought it up, which is, why should they be loyal to a corporation? Why should they expect that there would be any benefit to being on staff or a full-time employee at Corporation X if Corporation X doesn't feel that same sense of loyalty to them, which clearly the pattern exists out there that there should be no expectation like that in corporate life. I'm also expecting there to be a boom in entrepreneurialism in the United States and probably around the world in the next 20 years as a result of the stuff that's going on with the introspection and evaluation of life that people are going through while they've been more or less isolated for the last couple of years. Thoughts about anything that I just talked about?
Well, I think, as we said, there cynicism about the promises that their parents were proffered and did not stick with by the large corporations. So they start from an often cynical mode. And that's why retention has been a strong issue in corporations. And the means of retention are very different from the past. They're not just financial benefits or others. Many of them would trade off would rather have 2 weeks extra vacation a year than $2,000 increase in salary, and trade off of things like that. I keep telling people that are working in services on personal development to attach themselves to benefits programs, because one of the key things that folks are looking for is, how are you, corporation, going to help me personally develop as sort of a primary test? Why should I stay here another year? And my expectation is less about give me a few more piles of money or options than offer me something that helps me personally develop. And so you're committed to a lifelong development. And that's where schools, we have to change as well. We're getting into a lifelong commitment and participating as occasional personal development assistants and aides, as well as they accumulate experiences. And that's where the nomad type structure reflects that. These people are not going to live in Costa Rica for 2 years, then go to Portugal for a holiday. They're going there to work, but they're going to build experiences along the way of doing that. And they see that as personal development as well.
It is, and you know, something I've been nosing into pretty hard is this difference between teaching and coaching, and the teachability and the coachability of the candidates that I'm hiring. I look at it as two different things. One is, you know, how quickly can you build a baseline proficiency in some new skill or new area of development that you know is strange to you, but defined enough for some other person to actually teach you. How quickly can you catch on, and how do you catch on? What is your learning style? Because I've challenged everybody on my team. You need to know that if your boss comes to you and says, hey, I need you to be an expert in this next week, what's your best way to acquire that knowledge and that capability set and turn yourself into a full-fledged learning mode until you build that baseline? You need to know that. And everybody's a little different.
It's often through a project or initiative. I'm teaching a class this fall called Appcology, and I tell the students at the beginning, you're going to leave with a portfolio, not a certificate. And that's part of that difference. They learn through the portfolio of projects and initiatives. So they will pick up Python, they'll pick up JavaScript, they'll pick up R in the process of doing interesting things. And so their motivation for picking up those things and mastering to some extent is in the accomplishment of something they want to solve, they want to resolve as well. And the part of the tension to me is I have to get them not only to do what they want to do, but I have them do another project where they work for somebody else, because they like to work on the things they want to do themselves, but they don't always then build the skill sets that you require to get them to align with the requirements and aspirations of the project owner.
Yeah, and we talk about, you know, the other factor there being coachability, right? You know, can you be coached effectively? Not just can you learn something on your own or from a teacher, but, you know, once you have learned something, how do you access that external coach that can actually help you be better, even if the coach is not great at that? You know, and you can kind of think about the, I use the basketball analogy a lot for this, which is, you know, Michael Jordan always had a coach, even though he's the best basketball player of all time. No offense to all the fans of LeBron James, but they're just wrong, and they have a right to be wrong. Michael Jordan is the greatest of all time. But Michael always had a coach. And interestingly, you know, a few years ago, LeBron realized that, you know, even though he was a dominant inside player, he didn't have a good three-point shot. So he hired his own coaching staff, in addition to the team's coaches, to just drill him and to help him learn how to adjust his game and advance, you know, into a new skill area. And so even the greatest players, right, will accept the idea that I'm not as great as I could be yet. I still got some headroom here. I got some potential, but I'm going to need somebody else to help coach me through that. And be open to that coaching when it's offered, instead of saying, well, look, you know, I'm already the greatest of all time. Don't you know that? You know, leave me the heck alone. You know, you can't do what I do with the basketball. It's the same in IT, right? We've got a lot of people that I think when I interview them and they already know everything, I don't hire them.
Yeah, and we know that it's a lifelong learning. I began in computing in 1966 with the IBM 7044 transistor-based based computers, and so I've been in over 50 years in the computing domain. I went to computer science program at Purdue. I was in the first four-year computer science program. I know in the U.S., if not in the world, at Purdue University that we had at that time. And so I've been observing these dynamics all through the period. And so I'm sort of a Forrest Gump element, because I work with John McCarthy, who is the individual who coined the term artificial intelligence in 1956, and Doug Engelbart. I still work with Vint Cerf and TCPIP, and worked along all these, a lot of these milestone activities through these processes. And each time you find deficiencies and you personally develop and start a reach of something new. That's why I challenge too much of today's discussion is this standing start. Here's where we are today. What is next? I almost hate next, because it doesn't reach far enough horizon to look at the future. And you look in your domain, whether the mortgage industry and others, asset records going forward. In fact, I was talking with somebody yesterday about AI and humanities, and we're looking at, there's a tagline of a moral mortgage that you take when you build a system and when you own any property. What's the moral mortgage that's a part of your responsibility that attends to your release? In your case, maybe a release of a software system that supports a practice in the industry. And should that be subject to change or challenge, are you facile enough to adjust the platform to accommodate the needs of that that new environment?
No, it's exactly the way I've been thinking about it for a while, which is, you know, several years ago, I had a great job with a company that bought 21 different CRM systems, each kind of focused on a particular niche in the marketplace. So one of them might be for, you know, small manufacturer, one might be for, you know, a manufacturer of medical supplies as opposed to paint products, let's say. And the language was really different for each, even though a CRM is a CRM is a CRM, and, you know, and a business is a business is a business until it's not, right? And you get down to this kind of interesting world where, you know, if I bring a solution from Pepsi to Coca-Cola, right, they try to run me off first thing they can because we're not like them, Walt. We don't do the same thing. I'm like, yeah, you sell syrupy water. You know, what the heck, right? What is all this uniqueness talk from you guys, right? But you have the same problem if you go from Lowe's to Home Depot, right? You know, we're not like those guys. We don't do what, yeah, you do pretty much the same thing, guys, right? But yeah, we're so different.
Now, I would have agreed with you when most of my students were from Home Depot, but now one SOB, a student of Ben, is the CEO of Lowe's, so I have to balance now.
Well, my point though is that, so when I was on that CRM hunt, right, one of the things that I was trying to do was go, okay, well, I know each of them at the presentation layer has unique requirements, you know, and it's really mostly around the languaging, right? You know, they have industry specific languages, just like mine does. I mean, if you don't speak mortgage coming in, it's a good learning curve, right? It's a high learning curve because we have a unique language. Medical profession has its own unique language. Almost every little niche has its own language. But the functions of what we deliver from a systems perspective, especially when we define a system narrowly as a customer relationship management tool, what you see is form follows function, and these guys, CRM after CRM, does pretty much the same things functionally. How they present, right, though, is a little different, right? So the question for me was, Walt, could you collapse all of those 21 back ends down to one with 21 front ends that are different from each other and unique, right? So that we don't have to support 21 back ends, we only have to support one. And we have 21 front ends that make the customers really happy.
And how to do so without ossifying the back end and locking you in. You always have to red team yourself, mm-hmm. and making sure that back end, while creating an efficiency operation and maintenance, is also ready to shift and migrate. When we start defining challenge, what does customer mean? What does relationship mean? And what does management mean? I can challenge each of those terms and create a whole different world. And so part of my test of that CRM is if I challenge each of those terms, will this platform serve me? What is a customer? UPS, for example, in talking with them, when you first deal for many years, when you said customer, it was shipper. The person that is shipping is the customer. And it was tough to get people to think that the consignee, the receiver, is a customer as well. And in fact, of huge growing importance to it. So you saw that evolution inside UPS 30 years ago, where they started to understand that the historic character of what constituted a customer is evolving itself. And when we start thinking about everything people related, mortgages on digital assets and other factors like that, I'm starting to challenge is, can your platform be repurposed for digital asset management, digital mortgages?
And I think about a lot of the stuff I got from a guy named, I think it was Kurt Schickster, that did a lot of work on indirect integration and the challenges of, you know, our kind of our default back in the 80s and 90s was, you know, the simplest thing is to hardwire it all together, right? And, you know, hard code it is a phrase that, you know, has become frowned upon. But, it, you know, if you looked into a lot of the big companies in Atlanta that have particularly mainframe systems, what you're going to see is there's a lot of, you know, hard wiring and hard coding in those systems still. They haven't been able to abstract up and get to parameter-driven scripting and parameter-driven, you know, capabilities within those functions. And so they're locked in, right? To use your word, they're ossified into a certain level, right? And yet if they had been, you know, willing to think about the math of direct integration as opposed to indirect integration, you'd see pretty quickly that the more you hard code or hard wire everything together directly, the greater your hairball becomes, right? The giant hairball of corporate America.
Thank you for joining us for the conversation on the future of work. Please join us for the last part of the conversation of Series 3, Part 3, where Walt Carter and Dr. Ben Kaczynski wrap up their conversation on the future of work.